I guess we're live.
Log Talk Radio.
Now we're live. Hello, everyone. This is Carl from the Incredibly Strange Film Podcast in Deviant Legion. We are very, very happy to introduce our guest today. One would be the writer and co-author of the new film, The Pale Door. Okay, I made a mistake when I made the link. It says The Open Door. It's all my fault. We'll get that done, and we'll have it correct. That's no problem at all.
He will be
fine. That would be
no worries there.
Yeah, it happens. And that would be Keith Lansdale. And, of course, we have somebody else here that I want to introduce.
Really?
And that would be his father. So we have a father and son reunion today. And
yay.
I'd like to welcome also
here.
Joe Lansdale. Hello, Joe. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. I got to say something before we start. So I have interviewed Joe in the past, and Joe gave me a recipe for what I like to call now Huevos Lansdale, which I basically always cook on Saturday mornings. So I wanted to thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So Keith, tell us a little bit about the film and how you got involved, and we'll get into everything here. But tell us more about the film, where it can be seen, all that sort of good stuff.
Okay, well, the film can be seen a few places, but I know that the easiest way for people to find it has been on Amazon Prime. I think it's on there for rent, and I'm not sure if it's for purchase on there yet, but I know you can at least rent it. I know they're looking at some sort of a Blu-ray release, I think here in a month or two. I'm not real sure on the exact date of that yet. But the film came about when I was on a panel with my dad and Aaron, who is the other co-writer. And we just thought it might be kind of a fun idea to work together. And, you know, but we hear that all the time. Oh, we want to work with you. So I didn't think too much of it, but it wasn't. But a couple months later, they showed up at my hometown wanting to go to lunch and talk about ideas. And they said, hey, you know, we thought, what about a cowboys versus witches movie? And I thought, well, that sounds more like a broad idea than anything else. But if they have anything with it, sure. So they sent me over a script that, you know, was kind of a bare bones idea. And then I beat the hell out of it until it looks like pretty close to what we got today. So.
Okay. So one of the things I think that needs to be mentioned with your both Joe and you is that Texas and is such a character in this, at least from what I see from the trailer, and it's just amazing that you all bring something from where you live. So let's talk about the regionality of it.
Well, that's filmed in Oklahoma, by the way.
Oklahoma, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, but, I'm wrong. Again.
When it comes to Dad, you can usually assume Texas anyways, but this was actually one of those things where, you know, obviously it's just crossed the line here from us, but, yeah, this one was this one didn't really have a specific place, but I guess when people think of Westerns, for some reason, people think of Texas also. So it kind of happens naturally. But yeah, this one's technically over the line here.
Okay. So give us a little bit about your background, Keith, in terms of how you got involved in film. I was taking a look at your IMDb, and of course you started a while back, actually, with a film that I'm not familiar with, which is Christmas with the Dead. But tell us how you got involved in writing. Was it all from your dad, or was it something?
Yeah,
that
I mean, the
to
thing
do
is, that I was already doing comics at that time. I was you know, having a little bit of success trying to figure out how that all worked. And the local college here in town, this is Nacogdoches, the local college here in Nacogdoches wanted to do something with Dad. You know, he's obviously a local celebrity, and they have a film department, and they thought, you know, why not try to work together? Well, just because of different rule sets and everything with the Writers Guild, he couldn't write something for the budget they were looking at, which was about $5 and everybody's best wishes. So it was kind of one of those things where if we wanted to get it made, we had to find another writer, and Dad came to me and said, hey, you know how to write comics, just write them only they move. And, you know, he helped me make sure I understood how the structure worked. You know, he kind of helped me with the process of shifting over from comic writing to script writing. But I took a stab at it, and it was originally a story that – it was a short story of Dad's, but if you filmed it from start to end, it might be 15 minutes. But the problem is that there was a dog, and we didn't want to have to pay for a dog because, like I said, it didn't have quite of a budget. And – then it was kind of one of those things where if you cut the dog out, you pretty much cut half the movie out. So I was given more of a broad idea and set loose upon the world, and somehow I ended up making Christmas with the Dead with that.
Well, you know, again, the sense, and I don't want to really bring it up too much, but you know, having your dad – who, of course, for those people that are listening that don't know, your father wrote the Happ and Leonard series, and, of course, Bubba Hotep, and he did a lot of work with Don Coscarelli. And so the people at Incredibly Strange Films know him a lot. But growing up with your dad, how much influence did he have on you to become a writer, whether it be of comics or anything else? Was that something
ingrained? He never forced it on me or anything, but it was kind of one of those things because a lot of the opportunities were there. It was just easy to take advantage of, and because I had a little bit of an interest in the beginning, which, you know, turned into a bigger interest as it went on, it was kind of one of those things where it was a perfect storm. It was one of those things where a lot of the times we were talking about movies and things, and I didn't realize that I was learning plot structure and character development, whereas, you know, it was kind of Dad naturally wanted to talk about those things because they were his interest, but also because he was kind of secretly training me, and I didn't realize it till years later whenever I would start to write a scene and look back on conversations he and I had and realize that there was one for every need.
Well, you know, that's part of, you know, part of the legacy. You know, you're being taught by a mentor, and your mentor in this case was your dad. So Joe, let me ask you this. Seeing your son and doing the work, I would think that there's some sense of pride or you know, accomplishment. And what do you think of Keith's work?
Well, I was proud of him no matter what he did. Like he said, I never pushed him to do these things. But, you know, I always felt toward that sort of thing. You still there?
Yeah, still here.
I thought I lost you for a second. He had toward those things, and he was really interested in film, and I felt like that was probably his strength. And so I would, when we watched films, I would talk to him. You know, we'd watch it, then maybe we'd watch it again, and I'd talk about, yeah, you see this scene there. Why do you think that scene's like that? And, you know, I could tell that he had some insight into those things and some directorial insight, which I've always felt he'd make a good director.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm proud of him, of course. I was proud of him before that, but of course I'm proud of what his accomplishments. And you know, he's done a lot of comics, too, and he's had not only the full-length feature, Christmas with the Dead, even though it was low budget, and this. He also has one based on a story of mine called The Projectionist, a screenplay that's been optioned multiple times and may well get made next year. I hope so. And I will direct it if it gets made. But right now, we just accept the option money and hope for the best.
Well, that sounds really good. That sounds really good. So, Keith, tell me a little bit about your comics.
I should throw in one more thing, though, too, is that Keith and me and my daughter wrote a short story called The Companion, which was actually filmed for Creepshow. And we didn't write the script for that, but I just thought that's another, you know, film credit that he has, too, at least from the standpoint of
the
story.
Yeah, and I was going to get to Creepshow here in a little bit, and we'll get to it momentarily. But, Keith, I wanted to ask you about your comics. Okay, and what you did there, and are any of them available, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, I actually don't know what the availability of The Crawling Sky, which was one of the larger, I guess, syndications that was there, but it was 4 issues, but it's been a little while, and I honestly haven't looked to see if it's still for sale or not, but that was something that was based on another of Dad's short stories, but I tend to be the one who, anytime they want Dad to pick up the mantle and do a comic for, Dad kind of usually pushes that work towards me. He tends to enjoy, you know, the other writing projects more, and he knows I like to do the comics, so it just kind of works out in my favor a lot of times. The one before what I'm doing right now was the X-Files, but I think it was kind of one of those where it closed out the run they had. So I had an X-Files comic, which was really pretty exciting for me. It was a two-parter that we did. And, you know, since I grew up watching the X-Files, I've always been a big fan, it was kind of neat to be able to be a part of that in any way, even if it was just the comic. And as of right now, I'm finishing up the newest edition of the Red Range comics, which is something, I don't know if you're familiar with or not, but about 20 years ago, Dad wrote the original Red Range, which was this, it was almost kind of like a superhero origin, but Western, and dealing with racism. And as the comic develops, it kind of switches more into this weird sci-fi, Jules Verne, you know, odd, into the center of the earth type story. And when it got to the, you know, the spot where the possibilities were endless, he kind of said, all right, I'm done with it, and put it aside. And all the years later, people kind of wanted to know, well, what happened? So in normal procedure, Dad sent that opportunity to me. So I picked up the mantle and wrote, already had one that came out that was the pickup from where he left it off. And I'm finishing up the second one now, and that's supposed to go to my publisher. And hopefully, with everything in the world exploding right now, this doesn't end up, you know, lost in everything. But if it doesn't, then we might have the second one come out not too long from now, maybe sometime next year.
There's
okay,
also
good.
Creepy and Vampirella.
Yeah, also. So, yeah, that's okay. There's also, yeah, Creepy Comics and Vampirella I did, and there was a... I don't remember. There was another one that had a dog, cat, and baby story, and I don't remember which comic that was.
Oh, that was Five Bizarre Hands comics from Dark Horse.
Yeah. Anyway, there's been quite a few, but that's the ones that I'm working on most recently.
Well, good, good. I'm glad to hear it. So tell us a little bit about the Creepshow, how that worked.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of one of those things where when I was 12 and my sister was 8, they approached my dad, and, you know, he was obviously a horror writer at the time. And so they got a bunch of horror writers and they had them all write stories with their kids. And, you know, I sat on one side, Casey sat on the other, and Dad pretty much just kept making sure we were staying in line with what we needed to do. But it was kind of a weird little story that Casey and I did that had the companion. I don't know if you've seen it or not, but it was this scarecrow that ends up chasing this boy around the house. And, you know, it was a fun little story we wrote. Like I said, I was 12, didn't think anything else of it. Decades go by, and then all of a sudden Creepshow says, hey, we want to put the companion in one of our episodes. And so, you know, they were nice enough to send me a check for that, and I didn't really have much else to do with it because somebody else wrote that script. Matt Vane wrote the script, and it was, you know, it came out pretty fun. I think the ending's a little abrupt, but other than that, I've got very little complaint.
Well, you know, I mean, it's really interesting to me that, you know, you're able to do all these things and do these different things, Keith. And of course, you know, Joe, you know, what you've done over the years is just amazing. Oh, no doubt about it. So one thing I want to do ask while I have both of you on is Joe, what projects do you have happening?
Oh, what do I have happening right now? Well, I have I have three books out this year. I had Jane Goes North, which was from Subterranean Press, and then from Tachyon, I had a Happ and Leonard short story collection when they were young called Of Mice and Minestrone, and then I had a crime novel from Little Brown Mulholland called More Better Deals. I have a collection of short stories coming out, I think, next month called Fishing for Dinosaurs, and then, if all goes well, they're supposed to film The Thicket with Peter Dinklage next year. It was supposed to happen this year, but it got put off for obvious reasons. And then again, the one that Keith scripted from my story, The Projectionist, is one I'm supposed to direct hopefully next year. And in fact, Keith was set to direct one himself right about the time the virus actually hit the United States. So, you know, we got derailed on all that. We'll see what happens. But I've got other projects coming out next year as well.
Okay. And it's amazing what you guys do. And of course, I do have to say something here. My former co-host is a gentleman by the name of Stephen Ronquillo, and you were part of that podcast, Joe. Stephen is not doing well, particularly health-wise, right now. So, say a prayer for him, or to the gods, or to the witches, whatever works.
I'm an atheist, so just have to tell him I'm thinking about him.
Okay, I can do that. I will do that. So, what else do we have? Okay, so let's do a little more on the Pale Door in terms of
Let me add something before Keith talks about that. I was just going to say that I'm a producer on that film, creative producer more than anything else, and I helped attract some of the actors and talent. And at least a couple of the actors in the film are from the Happ and Leonard TV show.
Oh, and who are they, by the way?
Well, there's Bill Sage, for one, and, I'm going to have a blank here. Pat Healy, yeah.
By the way, I'm a big fan of Pat Healy's.
Who isn't? You should be. He's fantastic.
Well, if you know who he is, but one film that you need to see of Pat's is The Innkeepers, which is Ty West's film, which he's just marvelous.
Yeah, no, he's terrific, and Bill Sage is like one of those,
he's
guys
also
that's
really,
always
really
steady.
Guy,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah. Bill Sage, he's one of my favorite actors, in fact.
Good. So Keith, tell us how this all really came about, and from like where it started and how it all ended up in production, and just give us an overview of The Pale Door.
Okay, I kind of talked about it a little bit beforehand, which was just meeting Aaron and them sending over that story, but it was kind of one of those things where it was a rough draft if it was a first draft. It was kind of, still needed a lot of work, and I ended up doing a lot of hammering on it, but I felt like by the end of it, it was something that we could make for the budget we were looking at, with the actors we were looking at. And I don't know, by the end of it, I thought it was a lot of fun. I know it's kind of getting mixed reviews as far as people, but if you like, low-budget horror, if you like cowboys and witch stuff, I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's a solid movie. Now, is it going to be, the next biggest movie ever? No. But is it fun? Yes, I definitely believe that.
Okay, so tell us a little bit, if you can, I don't know if you're able to, in terms of production, the raising of the funds, so on and so forth, or anything like that. Maybe that might be your father's.
I have no idea how they raised funds. Dad may know more, but I know Aaron, he's got kind of in the vein where he's been doing some low-budget horror movies for a while, so I know he's kind of tapped into the right people. So that's pretty much what they told me. We know how to get this funded, and we will get this funded. And I said, that sounds great to me. Just make sure the check clears.
Yeah, so Aaron's a bulldog. Yeah, Aaron's a bulldog. He really is. And Cameron, too. Cameron Burns is his partner. And they're bulldogs. They have something in mind, and they're going to do it, and they keep doing it. Because, I had my doubts. I I'll say that right up front. And the way that film looks, it's a beautiful film. You know, the cinematography is just gorgeous. And so I was really surprised that for their budget, which, you know, I won't say what their budget is because that's up to them to say if they would want to, but let's just say that it was not monstrous. You know, it was not the most minuscule by any means. It was an appropriate budget. But they wrung every penny out of that thing. And I think that they had several different sources, and I think some sources changed in the process of putting the film together. And so I would say to anybody out there that's a would-be filmmaker that the most important thing to remember about film is that finance is the key. Because if you don't have the money to make it, it doesn't matter if you've got the best script in the world, the best actors in the world, a great director, you know, all that. It doesn't matter. You got to have the money. So that's one of those talents that I think Aaron and Cameron have is, you know, scooping up that money. And that wouldn't be one of my talents, as I'm a very good creative producer, you know, and I can contribute a lot through my, you know, knowledge and some connections and things like that, which is what producers do. But there are certain kinds of producers, and I may, in fact, have to learn to do that if I stay in the film business inside to go more independent. But there are people that have that knack of knowing how to connect with other people to make to convince them to let go of money to make a film. And, you know, anytime you do that, if you're an investor, you have to realize that no matter if, you know, I don't care who's starring in it, who wrote the script or any of that, it's always a crapshoot because film, first of all, that any film gets made is amazing. And that any film comes out as well as this one did is amazing. And most films don't turn out very well if they get made at all. So to me, you know, my hat's off to them because they were relentless in this because several times, you know, they would tell Keith, we're working on the money, and I was going, yeah, I'll believe it when I see it, you know, which I think is a realistic view. You know, you have to because that's anybody. I don't.
He's really not kidding. Just to pause you for just a second, Dad, he's really not kidding because it's kind of become the thing where we talk about, oh, this would be a great idea, this would be a great project. Everybody talks about it. Everybody shakes hands. A little time passes, then we have the exact same conversation like the first one ever happened. So it gets to where you know, you just go, okay, yeah, sure. And yet Aaron and them, like I said, when I talked to them at that panel, it wasn't but a couple months later, they were here in my town, which they live in Austin, so we're looking at about a five-hour drive. But they drove 5 hours just to have lunch and talk ideas. It wasn't but a couple months after that, they shot me a script, and it was a year to the day we met that I was headed to Oklahoma
to see
this thing filmed.
Yeah. Well, you know, on that panel, that very same panel that Keith and I were on, when he said that idea, I went, wow, you know what? I think that's a movie. I think that if you can, you know, get the right script, and like Keith, I thought we were just sort of, you know, talking, but I could, as somebody who's written a number of weird westerns, that sort of cracked with me. I thought, yeah, I think there's something there. And then apparently so did Aaron and Cameron, and then, you know, that's when they put together that script that they sent Keith. But I'm impressed with those guys. If I had to just pick one reason for being impressed, it would be their diligence.
Well, you know, one of the things we talk about in this series, and we've had Rob Schmidt, and we've had Trent Harris, and we've had Ted Nicolau, Mark Pirro, and they're all low budget, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that always comes through is that it's a sense of budget. It's a sense of if someone has to know how to do that, even on a really small budget.
Right.
You know, and when
probably
I see small, so. Say that again, Keith?
Probably more so. The lower the budget, the more somebody really has to be able to get every dollar out of every, you know, moment.
You know, and that even includes films like Mark Pirro has done films on an iPhone for $200. But he said, even with that, he gets the right people. It's a combination of getting the right people who can do different things to pull together a film.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just actors, not just directors, but it's finance, which is really, really important.
Well, yeah.
And this is something.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just saying, when you get over $1 million budget, which this, you know, this was over $1 million budget, and I won't say the exact budget, but, and in fact, I probably don't know the exact, because other, you always add more money than you think you're going to, because you have money to make the movie, but sometimes that doesn't always include money to promote the movie. It can, but I know when Christmas with the Dead was done, they kept having to find more money, and then when it showed overseas, it had to be translated, you know, so on and so on. So there's all of this little hidden costs sometimes that come along, or things that you don't prepare for, especially if it's your first film, and especially if it's a low budget film. A lot of people think, well, if it costs, if I can get $2 million and I make the movie, I'm done. Well, you might be, depending on how you spent your money. And sometimes you'll see a budget of $1 million, but it'll turn out they spent, you know, 50% of that on the actors, which is fair enough. But then when you add the writer into that, and you hope the writer gets paid properly, they don't always on low-budget films. But if you're like me and you're in the Writers Guild, if I were working for it, I would have a, you know, if I decided I would work for a lower amount, I have a standard amount. So you start adding the actors, you start adding the writer. Obviously, the director's going to get something out of it. The producer's got a percentage that they're going to get if this thing films. So, because they're putting the money into it, so they're watching you too, and so everybody involved and having people to build the sets. And the thing that was fantastic on this film was they had a set crew that was really impressive, because they built a church while the thing was being filmed. They had this old Western town that they had there, but they had this church they wanted to build for, you know, certain scenes in the film. These guys were building it as Keith and I were on the set. You know, I'm sitting
cut and they'd start building, and then you know, got ready to film again. They'd go quiet. So they were literally building between takes.
Yeah, and it was and part of their deal they made was that we will leave this set. Obviously, we'll leave this church part of the set with the rest of your Western town set as a, so-called gift, but in a way, it's how you repay the use of that place. You know, so you barter, and you also raise money. At one point, there was a film. Well, actually, when we shot Christmas with the Dead here in Nacogdoches, Texas, we'd go to somebody like Starbucks and say, you know, we wanted to see if we could get some kind of deal on coffee, so we got like a really nice deal on buying coffee from them, you know, and we had, there was a restaurant, Cotton Patch, and we got like a 50% deal. So there's all kinds of things like that. We sent my daughter out to talk to different restaurants, and then, you know, different people went out and did different things to cut that budget or to trim that budget. And even though that budget was small, I think we wasted $15,000 of it, and that's because we just didn't know better. So no matter what you're doing, you learn some things on the set. You sometimes hire people who don't turn out to be able to do the job. You might hire somebody that's just sterling and ends up saving you $15,000. So there's all of these things going on, and then you got the weather. And so if the weather, which was a big problem on Pale Door, they had a tornado, they had wind storms. I mean, these guys went through hell to get this this film made. But they were able to adapt. And if you have an outdoor scene, you better have in your mind how to make it an indoor scene if something goes wrong. You have to realize that sometimes you have to cut an entire scene and rewrite one real quick, or maybe find some way around that scene. So all of that is involved, not just with filmmaking in the way that you normally think of, but it's involved with money. Because when you have a day where you're sitting around, you're losing money. And so you have to be versatile, and you have to be able to manage, not only manage money in what you expect to happen, but you have to be able to manage money in what you don't expect to happen. So this makes this whole thing a constant moving target. And when anybody says, you know, I believe in the auteur theory, they're full of it, because no one person makes a film. A lot of people make a film, and sometimes the weather makes a film. It changes the structure of the film. An actor can come in and be totally different in their performance than you expected, and it can turn out better or it can turn out worse. And you've paid for that actor, you know, and you're ready to shoot. So trying to replace that actor is not easy. Or that actor really has a better take on it than you expected, or you adjust to that actor's approach and realize, you know what, this works really well. It's just not exactly what I had in mind. So when you add all these things up, you know, the people raising the money, the writer, the director, the people building the set, art department, you know, the director of photography, very important, of course, and the assistant directors, sometimes one, sometimes two or three. Well, you know, it's every one of those people contributed to that film that you see. So when you see a director come in there and talk about how they made the film, they should always remember, as should the people listening to them, that they may have been the general on the film, but the soldiers fought the fight. And that's what you got to remember. Those guys fought the fight. And I don't believe, I think a director can give it a tone and a look and all that. And they have to know who they want to be there and be allowed to hire the people they can work with. But it is not a singular achievement.
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, even what we do here as far as the podcast, I have people working for me and they all do yeoman work. And it's again, as I said, you know, it's like when you're doing a film, when you're on set, it's like a family. You're working together for this project. And hopefully you're all
right.
Working toward the same goal.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the problem with that is you also have people that just show up. You know, they're there to get their check, and sometimes they're efficient enough. You know, you don't always know, and it's an interesting craft, and I think it's a craft, not an art. I think it can be art, but what I mean by that is when a writer sits down to write a screenplay, when Keith sits down to write a screenplay, and I've written a few screenplays, I've written quite a few actually, but when you sit down to write a screenplay, you're not writing art. You're writing a craft, and the reason I say that is because you're not writing something that belongs to you. Maybe that first draft in your head belongs to you, and you might say that's art. But the truth of the matter is you're writing something to hand to – and you want to write it as – and I don't go by that it's a blueprint, and that's all it is. It's got to give you some sort of tonality, some sort of poetry, some sort of feeling for the story and the project itself. And so that all goes into it, and that's the artistic application. But you're doing it's a craft because you're giving it to other people to interpret. And when it's all said and done, it may turn out to be a piece of art because everything was just right and there was a lot of perhaps luck and accident involved in being that artistic piece of work. But when you write a screenplay, and I know there are people who will definitely disagree with me on this, but it's not art, it's a craft, because it's not designed for you. Unless you star in it, direct it, produce it, write it, build the sets, the whole thing, then you really can't say that. Because when I do it, and you know, I've written a script, even animation scripts, and I sort of pre-directed those. I had that opportunity, and I give it to them. They're still going to look at it like, okay, this is really cool, but you know what? The budget's a little squeaky here, so we're going to have to cut that. Or you write this wonderful scene that you think will be a brilliant fight scene, and you realize, and they have to cut it, you know, from 3 minutes to 30 seconds. All of that sort of stuff. So when you do this, you have to understand that you're giving them, it is a blueprint in one sense, but you're giving them as, I guess, as an exciting and as inspiring blueprint as you can imagine. But still, it's not meant to exist as you wrote it because it can't.
No, because the page is different than film. And that's always true. Adaptations.
Yep.
I don't know how many times I've seen things on ISF or other groups that I'm in where, you know, people downplay a movie because it's not adapted the way. And even I'll say that occasionally. But you know what? They're different. They're different animals.
Different animals. But what I was referring to, strictly speaking, was the screenplay, not the book. The screenplay.
Right.
Now, but the other thing, let me tell you this, and you're right, they are not the same, but every jackass out there always uses that, we're going to work in the spirit of, so they can sort of give you a screw-in, meaning that they don't pay any attention to what you've written, and all they want to do is make a movie, and they've already had plenty of ideas of their own, so they're going to cram that into their film. You find that a lot of times. And so it's not a matter of it not being adaptable. It's a matter of them not willing to adapt. Now, there are some things, obviously, just as you said, that you cannot adapt literally. But I often find that it's a way that people who make films abuse the source material when they make it from a book, is that they can always say, well, we couldn't manage that, so we didn't. And there are times when they cannot. But I've seen plenty of things, and even things of my own that I'm happy with, I would think, well, why would you change that? And or somebody just loves to write their own dialogue, and they come in and write some ham-handed dialogue when, you know, that the dialogue in the book is better. And I'm not just talking about me. I'm talking about any, you know, good writer who's written good dialogue. And sometimes they do better than what I wrote. I've had that happen, too. I go, damn, I wish I'd have thought of that. That's really good. But what I'm saying is that there's a kind of looseness in thought that I think keeps really good books sometimes from being adapted to be well. When I think of good adaptation, I think of Get Shorty. That is the book. They even used his dialogue for 99%. And the scenes are his. And that's just one of many. To Kill a Mockingbird, a great film where there's a lot in the book that they left out, but what they kept was in the book, you know, and they use that spine throughout. So there is a way to adapt to make it like the book. And then there's sometimes, like when Keith did Christmas with the Dead, you know, I have a 15-minute film if we filmed it literally, so it becomes just the beating heart of the story. So, you know, I'm not being absolutely literal, but I'm just saying that's an excuse many times just to, you know, make a film, but not necessarily make the film that you would like to see made from some really good book.
So, Keith, you've been quiet for a little bit. Do you want to add to that, or are you pleased with what they did with The Pale Door and your script?
No, I mean, The Pale Door obviously was one of those things where it was an original idea. You know, Aaron and Cameron did the original script that they sent me, but it was, you know, it wasn't based on a story otherwise that I, at least that I'm aware of. So that was kind of a not having to worry about in the spirit of. But, you know, with Christmas with the Dead, it was definitely one of those in the spirit of, but it kind of had to be. It just had no other option. So I think that it came out. I mean, honestly, I love Dad's Little Short Story, but I can strongly say that I think that the movie's more fun. I think the movie's, but mostly because it's got more characters, more things going, and I think that the original short story was more a fun idea than it was anything else. And those are kind of the best ones to adapt, because it's pretty much introducing you to this universe or this world, and it's saying, look, these are the people that you should care about. This is the world they live in, but then it's over. And this was kind of an option to say, hey, what would this guy do after the last page? And so that was kind of more of a, you know, the obvious conclusion to go from, instead of more a, well, here's a full story, but I'm just going to go in and do my own thing.
Yeah, and okay. You know, just to add something, I'll let Keith pick it up again, but it just to say, I'm not saying that as an absolute. I think sometimes people do better, but I'm just saying that it's often used in Hollywood as an excuse just to, you know, get the film out there and to use their own private interest to force it into a film where they could have just written their own script instead of, you know, wrecking somebody else's book. So, okay, I'm done on that rant.
Okay, well, that was a good rant. I've got no problem with that. Keith, I know, Joe, this may go to you, but I'll ask both of you. In terms of dealing with larger studios, and I know you have more experience with that, Joe, do you find it easier to deal with independents? With independence and doing it outside the system?
I mean, I haven't had any choice but to deal with low budget. That's as far as I've managed to make it so far. I've made a couple low budget films, and I mean, Creepshow probably had a pretty large budget, but they were still a short little 15-minute piece. So I don't know what they were looking at as far as minutes on film to budget. But so far, I've been pretty lucky that the people that have been involved in making it are trying to make what I'm making. And I haven't had, Dad, where he's had the situations where he'll have story, but then they bring in somebody else to just completely change everything. So, yeah, this is definitely more dad's world or universe than mine.
Yeah, well, you know, I would say that I much prefer working with independents. But you know, keep in mind that not all independents are easy to work with either. Some of them can be just terrible, just like you can, and you can work with some large studios and it'd be great. But generally speaking, the problem with a large studio is that the people you're dealing with are trying to maintain a job, not make a film. Because once they know they make the film, then they're judged on the basis of that film, and that's how their job continues. So it's better for them to have meetings, to have another meeting, and to prepare for that meeting when they're going to have the real meeting. And so you've got a lot of that stuff that wastes your time and theirs and wastes money, but it keeps them in a job. And again, I'm not speaking for all of them, but I've just seen this from, you know, numerous times, and I've written scripts with, I think, and I knew nobody ever really planned to make that film. You know, I got paid a lot of money, and some, and they got paid money to show up, but they're not going to make that film. I know going in that I know that this is just part of their process for a job, and then it goes on the shelf. And then there are other times when they seem to really want to make the film, but there's always this producer, and then suddenly there's like seven producers, and they're all going to get their slice, and the writer is just going to get sliced, period. And I think that that's probably the one thing that I have the most problem with film, especially when you're dealing with writers, and especially when you're dealing with writers with an original property, like a novel or a short story, is that when you get through, everybody else is the executive producer, and you got a little a credit and a small amount of money, and you know, and a kiss was tossed to you, and that's it. You're done, you know. It's to me that, and I think when I deal with smaller, you know, independent films, even though you may not make a ton of money, you know what you're going to make, and you generally know what you're up against, and certainly they can come up with numerous producers too. But I remember watching, you know, certain things of mine that were made, and I would think, wait a minute, that person is an executive producer? All they did was wander around on set. You know, they didn't do shit, or they did one or two different things. And then you would see a list of, you know, all these different producers on something, and not always mine, but I would know how this film was made because I knew the people who made it. And I would say, how did that turn out that there's seven producers, of which there are three executive producers, and the writer doesn't get a producer credit at all? They just get a script credit, and they didn't get paid that well either. So in my experience, it's a little easier to work with independents, though you can have similar problems.
Right. And of course, you know, with both of you being writers, it's very well known that the writer tends to be on the bottom of the pyramid in making a film, which is unfortunate, because without the writer, you don't have a fucking film.
Yeah. The writer gets no respect is the ongoing joke, but it's damn sure true.
Well, tell them about your hat, Keith.
Oh, God, this damn story. All right, so this is... I've told the story a few times, and it's funny in a terrible way. Whenever I first wrote Christmas with the Dead and we finally got around to shooting it, it was the first day of shooting. I was super excited. So there was something I wrote was being made. You know, this is a monumental moment for me. So I go to the set, and they have all the crew hats. You know, it's kind of one of those where it has the name of the production and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, you know, I look absolutely goofy as hell in hats, but I figured what a neat little keepsake that I should get. So I went up to the guy who was giving out the hats. I think he was the other producer. And I said, hey, I want a hat. And he looked at me and he said, well, the hats are for the crew only. And I said, but I wrote this thing. I think I ought to get a hat. No, I don't know if we have enough hats. And I was like, well, that's kind of a bummer. So I went and sat down and, you know, kind of moped a little bit, and a little bit later he walks up and goes, you know what, you're right, the writer should have a hat. So there I am, putting on this stupid hat, which, you know, like I said, I look ridiculous in, but now it's a matter of pride at this point. I'm really happy with my little stupid hat, and the sound guy comes up and goes, hey, I need a hat. And that dude looks me square in the eye and goes, Keith, give me your hat. And I could not believe it. I was like, what? So he looked at me and he goes, no, I don't want a used hat. So I went and put my hat in the car. I never spoke of it again. I never let anybody else get it. But, yeah, if the writer gets no respect, the writer doesn't even get a damn hat.
Jesus.
Yeah.
And if you guys on ISF that want to be writers, listen to that story. Seriously. Maybe you want to do something else. I'm not sure. But God bless the writer.
You know, there's that film Nosferatu where the vampire, they have the real vampire in the film, not the original Nosferatu, but the one that was remade. I forget what the title of it is right now. The vampire, it's supposed to be about the filming of Nosferatu. And the vampire is talking about not having, you know, anything to eat. And he said, well, you know, I don't remember the exact lines, but it kind of came down to something like, we've had the rewrites, and then you can have the writer.
Writer's
always low on the totem pole.
Oh, absolutely. And if you give me a second, I'll give you the name of that film because it starred Willem Dafoe.
On the tip of my tongue.
I always
think.
Like the Shadow of the Vampire.
Yeah, the Shadow of the Vampire.
Shadow of the Vampire. There we go.
No relation to what we do in the shadows, which is fantastic theory.
So one other thing I thought we would bring up before we end up here is, how do you feel about about how horror films are being perceived, and there seems to be so many more choices now with streaming and so on and so forth. How do you get your film seen? You know, how do you get it out there so people can see it and appreciate it? Because there seems to be
kind of the question of
a glut of films.
Anything you make. Getting it in front of people, I think, is always a challenge. I mean, honestly, it's a bigger challenge than anything else because it's just like what Dad was saying earlier. You could have the best film, best everything, but if nobody sees it, it doesn't really make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, the thing with Christmas with the Dead, which I don't even think it's available. It used to be on DVD. You could buy it for years on DVD, but I don't even think it's available there anymore. But the thing about that one, once we got it made, we tried to find a distributor, and we really didn't have any luck. We did get it shown overseas, and we got it shown. We four-walled it a little bit, the old method by which you know, make a deal with the theater, and you get a percentage out of it and all that. But the movie never got all of its money back, and people made a little bit of money that were producers, but nobody ever really made their money back. And it's not necessarily the world's greatest film, but it's a fun film, and it has a cult following. You know, there are people say, I watch it every Halloween, or I watch it every Christmas, you know. And they used to show it around town on come Christmas time as kind of a, you know, a tradition. And there was a chance that that film was going to get remade, and that chance has not necessarily evaporated, but we thought, well, this will be great, and then the virus came along. But nonetheless, that one, we did get shown a little bit, but one of the main problems is getting it out there. And sometimes you'll have people that make good films, and they just end up, you know, having them on Amazon and selling them on DVD, and nobody ever sees them. But there are some changes, you know, like with Shudder and, some other smaller streaming services. You're starting to see more of those things happening, and also things like Hulu and Amazon and Netflix are starting to pick up more low-budget films. So I think the opportunity is there, but there's also so many different things that no film really makes a splash like it used to outside of superhero films. And so used to, we would hear like, oh, this film's coming to town, and man, everybody was buzzing, and it was a real event. But now, if you know, it's harder because there are people that just watch Netflix, or people that just watch Amazon or Hulu, or they jump back and forth. So the audience for those films and for TV shows has grown tremendously smaller, no matter how dedicated they can be, because there's just so much out there. So there's good and bad. There's more opportunities to get your film out there, but you also are competing with more things.
Oh, absolutely, and that's the problem. I mean, to really make a splash and to really get people to watch, you know, it has to be, you know, one of those magnanimous happenstances, more or less, you know.
Right. That, well, you know, there's on I saw, I can't remember if it was on Amazon or Hulu. I may be, you know, off on that, but I saw a sweet little horror film called Sweetheart. Is it a great, great giant budget film? No, but it's really tight, really well done, and it's a simple premise. And I think you would have to say it's a cousin to The Creature from the Black Lagoon. And I just came across it by accident, and I thought, man, this was ingenious filmmaking here. And they had a lot of underwater sequences, or at least a number of them, that were just absolutely fantastic. And you know, there are wonderful things about that film, and I really would like to know more about how they filmed it, what it cost, and all that. But if you want to see a good little horror film, it's that one. And then if you want to see a larger budget film that kind of got lost, it's Cold Skin, and it's based on a very good novel. And the film is very close to the novel. The novel's better. It goes into some of the internalizations better, which is the thing that film can't do. That's one of those things they can't do as well. But Cold Skin I recommend for a little higher budget film, and the lower budget is Sweetheart. So those are the two that I think about most recently that I've seen that I've enjoyed.
Oh, okay. That's good. Do you have any suggestions, Keith, of what you've seen?
So, of horror genre, you know what I saw the other day, and I didn't absolutely love it, but I loved watching it, if that means anything, was that Crawl, which was actually
the
one
of
the best suggestions
at some
point. But, you know, it's very simplistic, but it was fun as hell. And, I don't know if I would call that a horror movie or not, but it definitely felt like a horror movie.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a horror thriller.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have to say something about that film. I actually saw that here in New York City, where I'm located. And the audience of that particular screening went up and applauded and stood up.
Yeah.
It's
I
that
thought the
good.
Same way. You know, I saw it in a matinee, so that wasn't going to happen in a matinee in Nacogdoches. But I remember when I went, there were more people there than I expected, and people were cheering and laughing and having a good time. And I thought, you know what, this movie in its simplicity is like the old horror and thriller films that I used to enjoy. And I love that girl. I can't remember the actor. Girl to me, I'm nearly 70 years old. But the actress was just tremendous. And I loved her. And Barry Pepper, you know, I think he's one of the most underrated actors out there. And
I agree.
The special effects were terrific. I thought the pacing was terrific. And and Keith said, you know, he liked it. But I have to say, I loved it. And I loved it in its simplicity.
I think he liked it more than I did. But I enjoyed while I was watching it. But it isn't one that I would go back and rewatch a lot, if that means anything. But I enjoyed it the other day while I was watching it. So
I would watch it again. The thing that I really liked was just those little simple terras, like where she's swimming toward the boat and the alligator, and she gets in the boat and she says apex predator all day long. I've never forgotten that. I've always thought that was that line and that timing on that line. And of course you've had that line built up throughout the show. So I was very pleased with that. So Keith and I guess he gives it a B and I give it an A.
Yeah,
well,
I give it a solid B minus.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
Okay,
and
well,
and for
A
me,
plus then, if you're going to do that,
I give it a solid A, because of the audience reaction. Because I always gauge from that, and of course, you know, being in a theater, I know we do all streaming now, and we're not going to see theaters, and I do miss them because there is that communal experience.
You've probably never done the communal experience in East Texas. It's not as enjoyable for me because people tend to come and talk about their tractor from sitting two feet away from me.
When I go to the matinee, though, I never really have that. Everybody's generally quiet in there to see the movie. Now, if you go at night, then you got different people of different age, and it's a lot of young people. And I mean, I used to just get furious when I'm trying to watch somebody's, you know, having a conversation behind me. I think I've almost snatched two people ball-headed. And, you know, just because you just say, you know, for God's sakes, man, be quiet. We're watching a movie. And then they get offended, like, you know, you're the guy. But
what was the movie where I was really young and yelled
Signs.
At somebody in the theater? No, that was when you yelled at somebody. I'm talking about when I was really young and I yelled at somebody.
Oh, I don't remember.
Told them to turn around and told them to stop
aliens.
Talking or something.
Might have been Aliens.
Yeah.
But, you know, you just you want to go there for a good experience. But when I go in the matinees, I generally always have a great experience. Sometimes it's just me, but sometimes it's like, you know, 10, 20, a scattering of people. But when I went to see Crawl, it surprised me because it was, you know, I guess the word of mouth had gotten around. And I wouldn't, you know, put it as the greatest film ever made, but I think it's one of the better low-budget, simple films made. And I think I would call it a horror film, but, you know, my definition of horror is pretty broad. And it's only one of my interests. I don't think of myself as just a all-out horror writer or horror fan. I'm somebody who has written horror, but I've written westerns, and then I've written crime, and I've written historical and suspense, and
it's kind of funny that my last, you know, The Pale Door being a horror western, because I'm not a huge lover of horror, I'm not a huge lover of westerns, but I enjoy both, but... considering the fact that my most recent thing is there, just it's almost baffling, but at the same time, kind of amusing.
Yeah, and
it shows you can adapt,
and
that shows craft.
Yeah, and I find that I don't have a dislike. Any story I can get interested in, I think I can enjoy it as a reader or a viewer, and as a writer. So you know, so
I
for
just
me,
don't
I don't
like genre. I don't like
genre.
Because
I like literary genre most, but I also like just pure genre that works. You know,
exactly,
I mean,
I think it's something like. And sorry, Dad, I'm talking over.
That's
you,
all right.
But
no, you're right. Ahead.
Anyways, this is the prime example of one of my favorites is one of Dad's, and it doesn't fit in any damn boxes, and that's Bubba Hotep. I mean, what are you going to call that? It doesn't fit as a comedy. It doesn't fit as a horror. It doesn't fit as anything. It's a, you know, at the end of the day, its own little genre. It doesn't fit anywhere. And that's kind of the movies that stand out the most to me. Something that doesn't say, okay, here's the rules we got to follow. I like something that's bizarre and something that maybe ticks three or four, maybe even five genres.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Me too. And you know, I've been as influenced much by, you know, The Great Gatsby and For Whom the Bell Tolls, as I have I Am Legend by Matheson. I mean, my influences are numerous, so my likes are numerous. And that includes comics, and it includes all kinds of novels, you know, and all kinds of short stories of every different genre. And I consider literary a genre, too. But all of those things have influenced me, so that gives me the option to not burn out on any one thing. The worst thing in the world would be to me if I had to watch horror films all the time. And much as I like a good horror film, I don't like most of them. And I can predict most of them, or they don't do much for me.
Oh, yeah.
So when I enjoy it, I really am so pleased that it's amazing. So, but I think that the fact that I have so many different interests allows me to move around through different things and not feel obligated to any genre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the thing. And talking about Bubba Hotep, which was the first thing that I saw I connected your name, Joe, to,
mm-hmm.
is that, to me, that's a film about aging.
Mm-hmm.
There's an entire group of movies out there that it's just kind of under getting older sucks, and you can look at something like Bubba Hotep and it hits that, but also something like Up from Pixar, it's also getting older sucks, and yet it's there. You couldn't put those two movies and try to really say anything else about them are similar, but if you really pull back far enough, you can see they both have that getting older sucks.
Yeah, or getting older happens. It can suck. And you know, I'm getting older, and some of it does suck, but most of it's just getting older. And there are things that you can't do anymore, but there are new things that you know that you didn't know before. And so it's a trade-off, you know, and it goes from one direction to the other. So, you know, you don't always know exactly how that's going to shape out.
Okay. Well, we're getting to the end of the show here, and I just wanted to give a chance first with you, Joe. One of the films I do want people to know about is Cold in July.
Yes.
And if there's a chance that you need to see Cold July. It is just an amazing film. And, of course, Joe wrote the script for that. And also that's based on one of
your
stories.
I wrote the novel. I didn't write the script. I wrote the novel.
Okay, you wrote the novel. So, you know, mention that. Mention some other films and that are out there that people can watch.
Well, you know, people can go to Netflix and see 3 seasons of Hap and Leonard, which are based on my first 3 books in the series. And I think it's a really good series. There's some changes and things, but I was very pleased. I thought the writing and the directing and the acting and everything in it was pretty terrific. I wrote one of the scripts for the second season. And so that's on Netflix. Cold in July, I think you can get it on Amazon Prime still. And Bubba Hotep's all over the place. And there's been a new Blu-ray that came out. And part of that Blu-ray is they added me talking about the film. And there are a number of those kind of extras on there that I think people would enjoy. But anyway, that gives you an example. And, of course, Creepshow, you can go in and watch the first season of Creepshow, and it's a lot of fun, especially if you're in the spirit of that and knowing it's very comic book related and just a kind of quick surprise and a lot of, you know, cool special effects.
Okay. And Keith, let us know where you can all find this, particularly The Pale Door.
Like I said, I know you can find The Pale Door on Prime. I know it's on something like, I think Apple iTunes or something has a version of it. I the only place I've even seen it myself specifically to look has been Prime, because people who ask me, hey, where can I see it? It's easy to have an answer, you know, kind of more solid. So I'm just going to say it's on Amazon Prime. You can rent it for $5, I think, maybe 6. I can't remember. There's also one other project is we've got coming out that's a novel that Dad and I did.
Oh, that's right.
And, yeah, we should probably plug the novel because it's coming.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's called Big Lizard. And it's kind of a superhero making fun of superheroes type novel. It's got some pretty cool art that goes with it, too. But even though it does look kind of comic booky on the front, it's most definitely a novel. So,
yeah, and you got a big lizard, and his nemesis is called Big Chicken, and it has all kinds of weird stuff in it. I think it's a lot of fun. The reviews have always been fantastic, and it's actually not out yet, but it comes out soon.
Yeah, it comes out.
Okay,
I don't know. I think it's at the printer right now, so I don't know what sort of timeline they're looking at. But it's kind of one of those where you expect it to be a certain way, and though we do play with the superhero origin, we've also got our own little fun stuff going on with it, too. So.
Right, right. And it's only in a limited edition right now. We hope that it'll be, that will also add a more, average edition, so to speak.
Okay, good. Good.
Big
SFP
Press.
Definitely plug that. And, Dylan, I want to thank you very, very much for being on. I really appreciate
having
it. For you taking the time and doing it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah.
All right, Dylan, I'm going to end up
excited.
Here and oh, absolutely. I'm going to end up here and giving what we're going to be doing next. So, folks, again, thank you so much, Joe. Thank you, Keith, for being on. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, goodbye. Take care.
Okay. Take care, guys.
All right. Bye.
All right. Thank you, Keith. All right, folks. Just to end up here, want to let you know that on Friday, which is tomorrow, we're going to have the first ever First Filmmakers podcast with ISF. On Sunday, Danae will be having a show. Next Tuesday, we will be doing a show with Limes Marshall, our new host, and it's Terror with a Twist of Limes. They'll be talking about John Carpenter and his films, and we'll definitely have a call-in from either WK Press or from Troy Howarth, who just wrote a book on John Carpenter. And next Friday, a week from this Friday, it's going to be a very emotional podcast for me. A very close friend of mine by the name of Antonia, she passed away from liver failure. And she was part of the Reno punk scene. She was a DJ for a number of years, and she was my cuz. And that's our how we used to say each other. And so we'll be doing a memorial for Antonia Onofro on next Friday. And so that's what we have planned. And we've got more coming up in October, which is, of course, Halloween month. So we're going to be doing a lot there. Again, I want to thank very, very much Keith and Joe Lansdale for being on. And again, wanted to say for those listening, if you want to say a prayer for my former co-host, I know he's not doing well as far as his health. Please do so. And that's we help you get better, Stephen Ronquillo. So I want to thank everyone for listening, and thank you very much. And we'll see you tomorrow. Take care. Bye.